time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for September 14th, 2019. If you're a regular listener to NPR's Marketplace, which airs weekdays around 6 p.m. in our time zone, you may have recognized my voice. On Tuesday, a 3-minute monologue about our bicycle business aired around 25 minutes into the show. And what happened next was unbelievable. It was as if someone had unleashed a hurricane as all of our social media feeds lit up. Our website was overwhelmed. Our Facebook page had a gazillion messages. Our email inboxes were full. I really want to thank Bennett Purser. He's the producer who not only talked me through the initial conversation, but so skillfully edited and assembled the piece. I am very grateful. I am very envious of his talent. If you missed it and are interested in hearing it, you can log on to marketplace.org and click on the My Economy link at the top. The piece is titled A Small Bike Shop with a Big Customer First Idea. Yeah, baby, we were on the big screen, as they say. So now that I've patted myself on the back enough, let's do a show. Three great guests, three very different topics this evening. First up is attorney Deborah Bogarts. I met Deborah when Brian and I rode in Israel in 2017, and we've kept in touch through social media ever since. Deborah's law practice is in San Francisco. She recently posted something about canceling her membership in the luxury Equinox Fitness Club, where she took spinning classes, among other things. She said she loved her spinning instructor. Voting with her dollars, though, Deborah's reasons for taking her money elsewhere are a noble example of honoring your principles and calling out those who don't. Then it's off to Boulder, Colorado, where Sue Prant, executive director of Community Cycles, talks with me about Plungergate. I think I coined that phrase, actually. When a lane on 30th Street in downtown Boulder, notorious for being a tough place for cyclists, was mysteriously turned into a protected bike lane with a line of plungers glued to the pavement. Sue and I also talk about her work and how Colorado is handling some transportation issues. Finally, Kevin Wren of Wren Cycles, who is just back from Eurobike, gives us an overview of the show, a lesson in how the bike industry really works, and how he and his partner drilled down to find the niche that they now occupy with some great success. So first, it's off to San Francisco for a chat with attorney Deborah Bogarts. Hello, Deborah. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we haven't spoken in a while. I haven't seen you in a while, except on Facebook. But I wanted to talk with you about SoulCycle and Equinox and the controversy that's been unfolding around some sort of incident that occurred in August. Tell me about the clubs and how long you were a member. And I think you were a member of the Equinox Club.
Right. And this is such an important topic. And I'm so glad that you're sharing this with your listeners, everybody who loves cycling and spin class. So I moved my law office here about a year and a half ago at Union Square in San Francisco, and there's a lovely Equinox fitness center just 2 blocks away, so it's super convenient. There are 100 locations. It's a national chain, also in Canada and London. What they say is Equinox is the very best personal trainers and cutting-edge classes come together with inspired design, world-class amenities, and unique digital experience that truly inspire members every day. It's kind of bougie gym that's geared for upscale urban professionals who want a luxury gym experience. So I belong there, and that's where I take all of my spin classes. I also have been to SoulCycle, which is you pay, get this, $42 a ride for
what?
45 minutes.
Say that again.
Yep, $42
oh my goodness.
For a ride. And it started in 2006 in New York, and celebrities would come and work out for it. It's just indoor cycling. Not my cup of tea, not only because of the price, but also it's not what you and I do, Diana, when we ride, you know, more of a slow endurance rider outside on a road bike. It's, you know, little gym with weights that you use and you go up and down with your hands. So it's not really my fave, but what they do is they darken the room and they have neon lights with words like breathe and life and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. And the music can be really fun. And so each instructor is based on their music. And it's like a very good, sweaty, spiritual and community ride.
Okay. And how many soul cycles are there?
Actually, so many. There are 94 studios in the US, Canada, and the UK. And SoulCycle is, I think, a subsidiary of Equinox.
Okay, that was going to be my next question, what the connection between the two are. So are they publicly traded or are they privately owned companies?
I believe they are privately owned.
Aha, which is where some of this problem is going to come in. How long were you a member of the club of Equinox in San Francisco?
I've been a member of Equinox for a year and a half and loved it, absolutely loved it. And so, you know, I'm one of those people who's really sad to quit because it was, you know, you always want a gym that's convenient for you and has a slate of instructors and classes that you want. And that was it for me. So I quit as a protest.
So you surrendered your membership and you need to tell us why. So what happened? I think it was sometime in August that this incident occurred.
Correct. So word got out that one of the major shareholders of both Equinox and SoulCycle, he's a billionaire real estate developer, Stephen Ross, that he was planning to host a fundraiser for President Trump at his home in the Hamptons. And he actually did hold the fundraiser. And in one single evening, Diane, he raised $12 million to support Trump. So what happened was a backlash and a little maybe burst of consumer activism as a result of his doing this.
Wow. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Deborah Bogard. She is an attorney in San Francisco. She and I know each other personally from a ride we did together a couple of years ago. But this came across when you posted this. I had to go look into it. And recently there was an article, I think it was on Vox, that explained exactly what happened with SoulCycle. And what was really interesting was some of the statistics about what happened since August and since that particular incident, if you want to call it that, between the shareholder and the Trump campaign.
Yeah, I think there was a protest and boycott that did affect them. I'm not sure how much. And so, you know, kind of as a result of that, I got a letter from the new CEO of Equinox, as did everybody. And, you know, it was a little late. And I think what happened was they consulted with a PR firm. And so they decided to make a $1 million donation to benefit 5 charities. And you could go on to your Equinox app and vote for which cause should get, you know, your share of the money. And the causes were, you know, they were good. It's, you know, Cycle for Survival to beat rare cancer, Felix Organization, which is helping children in foster care, Heroes Project to help wounded war veterans, House Lives Matter to help ballroom community with LGBTQ, Move Our Minds to help women-based Alzheimer's research. My view, however, is that was too little too late. You know, to pay $1 million to throw at this issue is nothing. Think about it. Their CEO, and they lied, he is a major investor. Stephen Ross owns, it's called The Real Company, and they are the major investor in both Equinox and SoulCycle. So the first sent disinformation about, oh, Stephen Ross is, you know, just a small investor.
Right.
Then they came out with this, you know, we'll throw $1 million at it. And my view of that is, look, they also said, you know, this is about a gym and a workout. It's not about politics. But, you know, here is a company that talks about sweating spirituality and community when all politics is about principles and values. So they're basically asking me to set aside my values, and that's just not okay. So I quit in protest.
Do you think that other, I mean, clearly you were not the only one to quit. How effective do you think this boycott has been, or if it's still going on? And are people still joining or leaving? Do you have any concept of what's going on now?
I do. And Diane, I think it's disappointing.
It faded.
Well, it's not only that it's faded. It's just that I think, you know, you're okay to protest against Trump and values when it doesn't inconvenience you. And so, you know, I did this little informal survey in the women's locker room when I was quitting. And I just asked, you know, young people, there's a lot of those in their 20s and 30s, what they thought. And many of them said, you know, they didn't know anything about the issue. And I said, well, how are you going to learn about it? And they weren't really sure. So not a lot there. I asked some women that were, you know, more my age in their 50s and 60s, what they were going to do. One said, oh, you know, the saltwater pool, I really need that for my health. And another said, I found my best personal trainer there. So, you know, it's just for my health. I can't quit. So what I determined from my little survey of about 20 people was, you know, I don't think many people like to take action if it's inconvenient to them. And that's sad. And so statistically, I just read, or I talked on the phone yesterday to Equinox, and I was told that less than 1% of their members canceled, and they have 1,000 members at my club, you know, the one location. I'm sorry, they have 100,000 members. And so that means less than 1% means less than 1,000 members cancel. So, yeah, that's not too good. I think more may have a problem with SoulCycle since they have to pay per visit and they have to decide whether they want to re-up. But there's a little bit of contradiction for me. I hear I'm canceling, and yet, you know, there's a good chance that the toilet paper I purchased comes from the Koch brothers, right? So, or the Koch brothers. So, you know, I would say you've got to decide when the company's values don't mesh with yours and what you want to do about it. And for me, I had to take a stand.
According to Vox, on the article that they wrote, and that was September 5th, so it was just a few days ago, Their chart showed that of the week of August 4th, attendance was up 4.5%, but beginning with August 11th, it started to drop. And by September 1st, it had dropped 7.5% in the weekly attendance. Now, whether it's going to stay that way and whether it's going to continue to drop, I guess we're just going to have to see. But I would tend to agree with you that we either speak with our dollars and our actions or we don't. And this is not an inexpensive pastime. I mean, I think the amount to join Equinox was like $230 a month or something like that.
Correct. And then I also pay for a locker too. And then you could pay for an executive room, which is more. So it's not inexpensive. And you know, for them to say their focus has always been about building a community centered on values, not politics, is just not authentic, because you do have to vote for, I believe, what you believe in, especially in this age of Trump. It's very important to do so and to speak out. And if more people did, I think it would have had a more profound effect. So the connection between my spin membership and Trump's fundraising, I think, is important for me. So I have to look at it as what one person can do.
Have you joined another club?
I am. I go to spin classes at Pello, and I go to spin classes at the Daily Method in Fairfax. You know, there's plenty of other places. You know, it's a little inconvenient to change your, you know, spin classes, but it can be done. And for me, my values are important.
And I have to commend you on that and agree with you on that. And I really appreciate you giving us your perspective. It's nice to have a first-hand perspective on something like this. I will say that we did contact SoulCycle and ask them if they wanted to come on the show and give us their perspective, and they declined the offer. So I wanted to make sure that we say that during the show, that we're not just getting a one-sided conversation here. They absolutely declined. I felt like it was important to give them that opportunity.
I'm not surprised. The new CEO or chairman of Equinox sent out a letter to everybody, you know, as part of the PR campaign, and said, "We really care. Please write us if, you know, you want to discuss this further." So I did.
Of course you did.
I wrote a very sincere article, and I've had no response.
So there you have it. And that's sad. That's sad. Well, I really appreciate you taking time. I know you're really busy. And thank you so much. Have a wonderful time when you go on your trip this year. And we will talk again.
Thank you, Diana. And thank you for having this on your show. All right.
Bye. Deborah joined me from her office in San Francisco. I really appreciate her perspective, and I found her little survey results very telling of what our world looks like today. Yes, that was editorializing, but it's my show. After a short break, we'll be back to talk with Sue Prant from Community Cycles in Boulder. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back. I'm Diane Jenks, and this is The Outspoken Cyclist. When I saw a photo of toilet plungers glued to what turned out to be 30th Street in Boulder, Colorado, I checked out who posted it. Up came Community Cycles, and when I followed that trail, I found its executive director, Sue Prant. Hello, Sue. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show.
Hi.
Hi. So I contacted you because of the Plungergate. At least that's the name I gave it. Toilet plungers that seem to appear out of nowhere on the streets of Boulder. Let's start with that, even though I really want to know more about Community Cycles. What's with the plungers?
It was a protest, assumed by a citizen who was fed up with 30th Street, which is one of our more dangerous cycling streets, probably our most dangerous cycling street. And it's been that way for a long time. So he or she or they decided to take in their own hands and do a little impromptu protected bike lane.
Okay, so that's what it was meant to do, was to sort of cordon off one lane for allegedly for cyclists.
Yeah, like to mimic a protected bike
lane. Sure. You just wonder what, I guess plungers would work, you know, upside down. They're kind of heavy on the bottom and, you know, they stick up.
Yeah. They were glued to the street.
Oh, really?
And this has been a protest, yeah, but not such a strong glue that the streets department wasn't able to easily pop them off. This has been done in other places, so I've seen this, you know, online. I've seen that people have done it before. I can't tell you where, but I have seen it done before.
Yeah, it's sort of new to me, but I got a kick out of it. It just the idea that somebody would go to that trouble. So nobody really knows who did it.
No, we don't know who did it.
Okay. Do you think it accomplished anything?
I think it got some attention around the issues. I don't condone it or think it's the way to go about things all the time, but sometimes a little civil disobedience can bring attention. I mean, in that particular street, there is already a plan to make it safer, so it's not... You know, the city has addressed that. It's just a multi-million-dollar plan, and they don't have the money for it. But, you know, but that's sort of a beside the point. That's kind of a in-the-weeds planning detail.
Okay. Well, I just thought it was kind of an interesting way to bring some attention to the plight of cyclists in Boulder.
Sure. That's probably one of the most dangerous streets to ride a bike on in Boulder. I can't really think of anything with a bike lane that's more dangerous than that. So, you know, from that perspective, it's a good spot for that kind of action.
Let's talk about what you really do.
Mm-hmm.
Are you the head of Community Cycles? Is that your organization?
I'm the executive director. It's a nonprofit.
And when did it start?
2006.
And the mandate was to make cycling safer you do a lot of things.
Yeah, we started mostly as a bicycle repair shop so that you could bring in your bike to work on it yourself. And we would teach you how to do that. And we still do that, but we've expanded beyond that quite a bit. But that's still a big part of our mission.
That's cool. So do both kids and adults come in to get their bikes worked on, or can children come in, young people?
Yeah. kids under a certain age need to be supervised by an adult, but we definitely do have children doing that. We have a day camp that where kids are there learning bike mechanics as well. So,
are you a mechanic?
I'm not.
Okay, me neither. Even though I've worked in a bike shop for the last 45 years, I am definitely not a mechanic. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Sue Prant. She is the executive director of CommunityCycles.org. It's in Boulder, Colorado, the Republic of Boulder, as some people like to call it. So what else does Community Cycles do besides its bike repair program?
So we also sell refurbished bikes and rebuilt bikes at, you know, very reasonable rates. We give away a lot of bikes to the community. We give away about 500 bikes to kids around Christmas time in December. We give away bikes throughout the year to adults for other reasons. We have an earn a bike program where you work a few hours and then we give you a free bike. We teach tons of classes from basic fix a flat and mechanics 101 to more complicated things like building a wheel. We do a lot of advocacy. That's a big part of what we do. So we advocate for safer places to walk and ride a bike. And we have special events. We do outreach where we do bike repair and, you know, community classes and things like that in neighborhoods and at workplaces, things like that. We run the city's annual walk and bike month in June and winter bike to work day in February. That's sort of the overview
that's
of what we do.
That's a lot of programs. That's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. On September 5th, you posted an article on your site and you wrote it, apparently, 20 is plenty on neighborhood streets. What was that about?
Mm-hmm. So as part of right now, the city is going through the final stages of its transportation master plan, which sort of sets the tone for transportation planning and policy for, you know, like the next 5 years or so is when they do an update every 5 years or so. And this one, they did a really wonderful job and it's really, really thorough. But one of the things we're asking for is to reduce speed limits in residential streets. So these are strictly the streets where neighborhood streets where people live from 25 miles per hour to 20 miles per hour. So that would also be the default speed limit in the city. Wouldn't be on neighborhood collectors, which are sort of the bigger neighborhood streets, wouldn't be on larger streets than that. These are just the small residential streets. But 20 is plenty is kind of a worldwide movement, just recognizing that it is much more dangerous to get hit by a automobile or vehicle moving 30 miles an hour versus 20 miles an hour. So the likelihood of death like doubles just in those 10 miles.
Sure.
So this is an effort to slow down traffic and make people know that Boulder is a place where on our neighborhood streets, you know, kids play and pets roam and things like that. And so we want a slower, calmer atmosphere. And we're asking, and I think many residents would agree, that those are places where cars are guests and they should be calm.
So that was going to be my next question was, are you getting any pushback? I mean, certainly in New York City, as soon as you say anything to any of these residents, they're like, no, we don't want bike lanes. We don't want it slower. We don't want it narrower. We don't want any of that. Boulder's a different kind of city, I think. I think of it as much more sane and humane. Let's just put it that way. So are you getting pushback?
I'm not sure about that. Well, we've just started it. So, you know, we have gotten into the transportation master plan, but it is an ordinance change. So it's going to take a public process and we'll see how the public reacts once the public process has happened. One of our council people tells me that Brooklyn, where he also has an apartment, has 20 mile an hour speed limits on residential streets. So
Brooklyn,
it's not
New York.
Unknown to New York City, Brooklyn, New York. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not unknown to New York City. And I wouldn't say that people in Boulder are less wedded to their cars. In fact, you probably have a higher percentage of car ownership than you do in New York City. And it is the West where we feel like cars are a right, not a privilege. You know, so there, we certainly get pushback on things with cars too. Yes, we're open-minded. We like bicycles, but the Westerners also love their cars.
Yeah, don't they though?
And a lot of New Yorkers should be credited for the amount that they walk and take a subway. I mean, I'm from Philadelphia. I spend a lot of time in New York because my brother lives there. And, you know, the street design in those cities, in some ways, you're starting off with a more human scale design. And you're starting off with better land use that would accommodate walking and biking better. So, you know, it's a mix. Boulder's a good place, but it's certainly not perfect.
Yep. I haven't found that place yet, although I would like to believe that it's out there. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Sue Prant. She is the executive director of Community Cycles in Boulder, Colorado. So does Boulder have safe routes to school programs and complete streets plan? And does Colorado have a Vision Zero program? All those big, you know, programs that tend to have some national ideas behind them.
So Colorado and Boulder have a safe streets program where funding is available for communities to apply for safe streets grants. Not sure if this funding is still available, but certainly there have been a lot of projects in Boulder that have been done under that funding source. And there are people who work at the local school district. The way school districts are here is they don't have the same geographic boundaries as like municipalities do. But anyway, so within the local school district, which encompasses a few counties, there are staff that work on safe routes to school projects. The city of Boulder adopted Vision Zero a few years ago. They first started with sort of a tempered version of it, and then we pushed them to a more robust program, and they've pretty fully embraced the robust program. The county, however, Boulder County has not adopted it yet. And the state doesn't really have a Vision Zero. They do some stuff that they like kind of call Vision Zero-y, but I would say it's pretty lame and not really very effective. I think that's what, complete streets. Well, I know at least in Boulder, we operate under the NACO, which is National Association of Transportation Professionals, something like that.
Right.
Design guidelines, which are complete streets. So we don't design any roads that aren't complete streets. I think in Colorado, a lot of roads are probably designed that are not complete streets. There's a lot of variations in the state between urban and rural and suburban, and it's still sort of a desperate place. So, you know.
Well, I wasn't going to ask you a political question, but I'm going to now because it just occurs to me that your former governor is now running for senator. He was thinking of running for president.
Yeah.
And
he did run. Yeah.
He did. And then he closed that campaign.
He dropped out.
And, right. So what do you think? Is he the right temperament for a senator for Colorado? Does he have the kind of interest in transportation and infrastructure and the kinds of things that people and climate? And I think he is interested in climate change, by the way.
Well, I guess anybody would be better than Cory Gardner, who is in there now.
Okay.
Who is a Republican. I don't know that Hickenlooper is the best choice. To be frank, I haven't really looked at all the candidates yet. When he was a governor, he was okay on transportation. He could have been better. You know, he certainly liked the oil and gas people, and that doesn't really go that well with transportation. But he did also champion some transportation projects. I wouldn't say that CDOT has really been a leader in transportation. We have a new governor, Jared Polis, who I think might eventually be a leader in this area. I think he has promised. He's from Boulder, and he definitely is more progressive on these issues, on transportation issues. But, you know, as I said, it's hard spot to be the governor of Colorado because you have serious oil and gas interests, you have serious progressive interests, you have people are very conservative, people are very liberal. It's not a divided state in a lot of ways. So how to keep all those people happy is quite a balancing act.
Yeah, we live in one of those, Ohio. Actually, it's very lopsided. Yeah. It's mainly red, except for this northeast corner that we live in, which is heavily populated, but clearly did not carry the day in the last election.
Yeah, I would say Colorado is slightly more blue, but, you know, it's still got a lot of conservatism in it.
So in a perfect world, what would you like to see happen for, say, the next 5 years in Boulder? What would be the plan that would fulfill some of the ideas that you have for transportation in Boulder?
So last year on the ballot was a transportation tax, and transportation is seriously underfunded. It lost, but it won heavily in Denver and Boulder counties. So some sort of transportation tax that would accomplish these projects that we really need in Boulder County, one being the 30th Street where the plungers were, another being the Diagonal Highway, which is a town about 10 miles away, but we have these growth limits. So it would put a bus rapid transit and a bike lane there, or bike path, that whole distance. And that would be a real game changer. We've done the same thing on the road from Boulder to Denver, and it's really been a game changer. Additional funding on a large scale. So a ballot measure for the county or for the Front Range or something like that, that would pass, that would fund many of these great projects that we have in the planning hopper, and we've planned for them, and they're wonderful plans, but now we can't get them built. And they're so large scale that they're not something that the city's going to do by itself. So that's what I would wish for regionally. Locally, just within the city itself, I would like to see it be more bold. You know, we keep pushing them little bits, but more bold to embrace new ideas and innovations like 20th Plenty. And other things, more bike corrals and kind of these new things that maybe we've done a little bit around the edges, but we've never really kind of dove in and really, really made serious big scale change on the municipal level. And I think we're headed in that direction, but I think a little push to get us over that edge would be helpful. And if I had something to wish for, it would be that push. I see us headed in the right direction, but I see us needing a little push.
You sound pretty politically astute to me. Maybe you should be pushing.
We are.
No, I meant personally. It's just very
articulate. I don't want to run for office.
You know, it's so funny you say that. We have a local mayor who is kind of a tough nut to crack. And my husband looked at me the other day and said, "Well," and I'm like, "Don't even look at me. I have plenty to do. I do what I can."
Our council doesn't really pay much, and I need a full-time job.
Well, and there is that, too. I doubt that the mayor...
I have my hands full.
Yeah. Well, Sue, thank you so much for talking with me. Very interesting. We think of Boulder as a very progressive place, and being sort of this liberal kind of community in a state that I do think of as fairly conservative. So I have a really, really good friend. He's my quote unquote surrogate son who lives there. Someday I'll get out there to see him. He's actually from Erie, PA, which is just an hour and a half from us here in Northeast Ohio. But thanks for talking with me. Good luck with your programs. And I'll keep watching what's going on at Community Cycles in Boulder.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. You have a great day.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye. Okay, bye. Sue Prant joined me from the offices of Community Cycles. They certainly have a lot of programs for the locals and are clearly immersed in advocacy. If you're interested in Community Cycles work, you can log on to communitycycles.org. So after another short break, we'll be back to chat with Kevin Wren of Wren Cycles. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
And we're back. And so is Kevin Wren from Wren Cycles. Jet-lagged and full of new information, Kevin just returned from Eurobike, Europe's biggest trade show. Here's our conversation. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Hi, Diane. It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Jet lagged?
A little bit. you know, there's you got the combination of lack of sleep and the time difference, but so many different things happened over at Eurobike that you can't turn your head off. You know, for a startup company, the opportunities are pretty strong, and we had a great show. So you add jet lag to that, and I toss and turn, and then I get kicked out of bed. Why don't you go sit on the couch?
So. All right, I've had enough of that, right? Well,
yeah, right,
tell
exactly.
me a little bit more about Eurobike, startup company, and I know they had a lot of to-do about e-bikes, but
yeah.
you don't do that,
you know,
so tell me.
Well, we don't do complete bikes, but, you know, for me, I guess my first observation is the Eurobike show is shrinking. It continues to shrink. From what it was, you know, 12 years ago to what it is today. And I think a lot of it is similar to what happened here with the U.S. trade show demise. And major brands, for a European brand like Cube, they don't show up. They do the same thing that the major brands here in the States do, Trek, Specialized, Giant, you name it, with the private shows that go on in July. And so, you know, if you or I are a dealer thinking about spending money to go to the trade show, A, it's expensive, and B, you've already committed to make a major percentage of your purchase for next year. You know, some of these brands require 70-80%. So, you know, if we're a retailer that did $1 million last year in parts and accessories, we're committing to $700,000-$800,000 of purchases for next year, not even knowing how our season's going to finish this year. So,
right.
You know, the key decision makers don't come. That if somebody does show up at the show, it's usually staff from the shop, a mechanic, clearly somebody who can influence, but not someone who can say, I'm going to buy that product. So, you know, for a small supplier, I've done Interbike for the full 5 years that we've been in existence. And, it's impossible to justify the expense. And with retailers, you know, friends that I've known for 35, 40 years, they simply cannot go away from that contract that they have, whether it's, you know, a Bond Trigger product or the big red S. It's a problem for small suppliers like myself.
Right.
So, you know, overall, Eurobike, you know, the activity was there. For us, it was different. We had done a custom project for Strummer e-bikes, and about 2.5 years ago, we started a development project with them, knowing full well that they had exhausted the larger brands, Fox or RockShox. The project was fairly small and quite intensive, but it was perfect for us, and we took our time. We got the product right, the engineering work, the samples, the testing, the back and forth for securing the EU approvals. This is what they call a speed pedelec. So in Europe, the speed pedelec can do up to 45 kilometers an hour. It requires a driver's license. It requires a registration. So it is considered a transportation vehicle. And so after 2.5 years, we were basically forced to establish some things that are critical. You know, when you're selling a high-end product like authorized service centers, we had them in place in Europe and in multiple countries before the first fork even arrived at Strummer's factory.
Hmm.
So it probably advanced our entry into the European market by 2 or 3 years. We've been focused here in North America and doing very well, growing our business year after year. So gaining the spec on that Strummer, it's their top-of-the-line model. It's a model called an ST5, and it retails for about 11,000 euros. So
translate that for me.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's like $12,000, you know, U.S.
Yeah.
But there is a market for it, and we're very happy with the volume. And, of course, being associated with the Strummer brand was huge for us. So, no, overall, it was a good show.
We're speaking with Kevin Wren. He is the proprietor of Wren Cycles, a small-ish company in our business, but clearly doing pretty well. How did you decide to begin building suspension forks? And your forks, we will talk about them because I don't quite understand what you're doing, some inverted thing. I want to know about it. But
sure.
How did you get into the business to begin with? Why suspension?
Oh, long story. I studied. I spent 4 years in the seminary. I wanted to be a priest. And when I came out of that and decided I wasn't going to do it, I wound up taking a job selling office supplies door to door, and wound up the timing perfect that Shimano had just moved their office in the U.S. to New Jersey and became a customer. And the next thing I knew, you know, I was working for Yoshi Shimano. So, you know, it was one of these things that just happened. I didn't even know what Shimano did. When they said fishing tackle and bike parts, I thought fishing. And so 40 years later, I'm still in the bike side.
Yeah, I know. It like takes a bite out of you and doesn't let go.
Well, and it's great. I mean, you know, where you come from, something like studying religion, and you go to a factory and you see raw materials coming in. And I never had any of that, you know, in school, a metal shop or wood shop. And so I was fascinated, and I enjoyed it, and it's carried over. I went from Shimano. I worked for Union Frauenberg in Germany. I wound up heading up Cannondale's Coda development project with the Magic Motorcycle guys. That was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then you move on to more corporate structure like Bell Sports. And so I've got the full gamut of working directly with an owner like Yoshi and Joe Montgomery at Cannondale, and then working in a big organization like Bell. So, you know, you reach a certain point, and I had enough of the corporate, I'm not going to call it nonsense, but I had enough of the corporate nonsense, and approached some of the factories that I had worked with over the years to do sourcing and product development, and we started Ren Sports 5 years ago. And it's been fun. You know, we work with a lot of people that I've known for a long time, and we were able to start the business by getting some favorable, you know, tooling expense, and they would amortize it for me over so many thousand pieces. And, you know, it just really fell together well. And I feel very fortunate that my partner and I, Russ Johnson, Russ started at Shimano in 1976. So he's been in the industry longer than me. And so, you know, I'm working with a good friend. We just got back from a trip to Europe, and you know, we're out riding our bikes, having fun, and doing something constructive. You know, Russ is 69 and I'm 65. So, you know, we're having a blast and enjoying ourselves.
So let me ask you something about suspension right now. When I think of
suspension,
you know, I go back in time to the first suspension mountain bikes having a RockShox, the original, you know, kind of single, whatever it was, RockShox.
Mm-hmm.
It's become very, very sophisticated. You're talking about a suspension fork on an e-bike that's selling for multiple thousands of dollars, and it's got to come back down to something for the average consumer. How well are suspension bikes selling, and are they basically e-bikes, fat bikes, mountain bikes? Where is that market?
Well, for us, we had the opportunity to work. The very first fork that we had was a fat bike fork. And so we entered into a niche market, fat bikes, which a lot of people think is shrinking or dying. And we then further went into a category within fat bike suspension, where a lot of people will say, well, you know, big fat tire, it's got enough air, that's my suspension. And the whole idea of suspension is to keep your tire to the ground as quickly as it can. So, you know, you want to have that contact, and that's important. And also fatigue, you know, when you ride a rigid fork over a period of time, your shoulders, your wrists. So everybody can benefit from it. Not everybody uses it. And for us, you know, starting in the fat bike category, we really only had one major player, which was the RockShox Bluto. And so we attacked it. We came out with a superior product, and we backed that up with very easy to service. It's probably not good for the bike shops to hear, but a consumer can open up our fork, completely service it. There's no loose oil. Everything is cartridge systems, and you can self-service the fork. It really is that easy. So, you know, that started it, and because of the inverted design, we were able to limit our investment to just two specific areas, the crown, which sets your hub width, and the dropouts. And so we have one set of dropouts and four different sizes of crowns. And we can service every size bike from, you know, 20 inch all the way up to 29 plus. So it really is a great fork design. Our success has come in the fat bike category, and we've just recently started to promote our more standard products, the 110 Boost Hubs, for 27.5 and 29. So slowly but surely, we're making progress in suspension. And the inverted fork is extremely unique. If you think about standard forks and their design, one of the basic issues is the fact that all of your seals are facing upwards. So dirt, water, any kind of contaminants sit on that seal every time you compress the fork that's driving that material down into the oil bath or into the spring. With our design, we don't even use seals. Our cartridges are fully sealed both on the oil side and the air side. And we use wiper blades and gravity to push anything that's on the lower stanchions from getting up into the fork. The fact that the lighter mass, our stanchions on the lower section, enable the wheel to move more quickly. If you envision the force that's needed to move a heavier object like a standard fork's thicker sections that are at the bottom of the fork, you can see why an inverted fork makes a little more sense. It's a great design. I have to say, we have a unique feature called our twin air system, which basically utilizes two air valves, one at the top, one at the bottom, and a floating piston, which allows you to do infinite adjustments on the trail. You take out your air pump, you don't even need a shock pump, and you can make fine adjustments in millimeters, as opposed to standard forks where you have to open the fork up and put in a fixed token, which restricts the specific amount. So it's a little complicated, but it's a very, very feature-laden product, and we've had the success with it. You know, we focus in areas that need differentiation, like the Handmade Builders Show is a very good show for us.
Right.
We have the handmade builders that need to differentiate. We work with Wyatt Bikes out of Wisconsin, Proudfoot out of Colorado. And these are people that, you know, make, I don't know, a couple hundred frames a year, if that. And they have a passion for what they do, and they want to put the best product on. So it's a good location for us. We do sell through KHS distribution, and those dealers that don't deal with KHS, we sell direct. And we do quite a bit of business consumer direct, where we don't have a shop in a certain part of the country. So, you know, we found a nice niche with the fat bike fork, and with that, we were able to then expand into a variety of other products.
Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk with Kevin Wren some more. Before the break, we were just going to start discussing suspension forks. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Kevin Wren about suspension, and we don't really talk about it much. You made a comment a few minutes ago about the fat bike category declining, and so I want to say something about that because there's randonneuring. There are people who are now doing wide tires fenders. And maybe they're not called fat bikes, but I guess we would call them sport bikes. Are you when you talk about fat bikes, are you talking about the giant wheel bikes, those great big fat bikes?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, you know, our fork, if you purchase one of our forks, you can handle anything from a 26-inch wheel to a 29-inch wheel with the same fork. We have adjustments in it which allow you to keep the axle to crown dimension the same. So if you're putting something on an older bike and it was not set up for suspension, we can allow you to adjust the fork so that the head angle never changes. No stress on the frame, especially if you have an older, let's say, Salsa or Surly, and you're not going to crack the head tube, but you can still adjust the fork to get, you know, 70 millimeters, 80 millimeters of travel, depending upon the brand. We are the only fork manufacturer that does both tapered steer tubes and straight steer tubes. We're small. We can adjust. We can look at the market and say, people need this. If you have an older classic bike where it wasn't built for suspension. We allow you with a straight steer tube fork to be able to get suspension on that original classic that you have. And to me, that's important. It's servicing a need in the market. And I don't, you know, I mentioned corporate nonsense. I don't have anybody over my head demanding that I make 35% margin or that my turns are this or that. You know, we do things for the right reason. We put out a quality product. We back it up with quality service. We make sure we have every service part for that fork in stock. And so every step of the manufacturing process, we control all of our carbon products. We do carbon handlebars, carbon seat posts. We do a super lightweight aluminum stem, which, by the way, Tinkerwara's just won a world championship with.
Yes, very nice. Congratulations.
Yeah, we're really happy with that. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where I knew Tinker back from sponsoring at Cannondale with Coda, and he contacted us. So it's wonderful to see. And as I said earlier, part of our inspiration was really to, you know, do what we love doing and, you know, travel the world, basically, something we would have done in retirement, but now we get to do and let the company pay for it.
Right. You actually won another award recently, a NOMI?
Yes, we were really, really pleased. It's difficult, as you know, getting media coverage, especially if you're not advertising. It becomes really hard to get a positive review, but that's not true. I mean, you can get a review of the product. What you can't get is a shootout, because they don't want to go against the company that's spending a spread ad on this, a full page ad on that. And, you know, I used that leverage when I was at Bell Sports, you know, handling the marketing. So it's now something that we battle against. So we're very proud of that. Fatbike.com did a shootout, and we won the award for best fat bike fork. So, you know, it's really, really nice. We mentioned we do a standard 110 hub, boost hub 29er. And we have a rider in Hong Kong, a gentleman by the name of Brian Cook, that's sponsored by Trek. And he just won a downhill race using our fork. So bit by bit, we're getting it out there, yeah, that we do have quality products. And
So let me ask you a couple of questions. If,
sure.
If you have a rider in Asia who is riding a Trek with your fork, did he put that fork on aftermarket? That's my first question.
Did.
Okay, so that was his choice.
You know, well, gaining OEM spec is impossible for a small company like
right,
us.
Right.
The OEM sales are controlled. Yeah, they're controlled by the large fork brands. They can leverage other components. They can give you a discount on derailleurs and brakes
right.
and wheels.
Sure.
You know, and so we stand on our own. And, you know, we have costs, and I'm happy to work on an OEM basis for minimal margin because it's advertising and promotion when people use our product and have a good experience. The bicycle business is, there's way too, I was going to say a mess, but there's such overcapacity that if you and I went to Asia, we could start a bike brand tomorrow. Now, whether you succeed or not, there's no barrier to entry. You got a couple hundred thousand and you're in the bike business. So there's overcapacity, and the competition for these bike brands, you look at the sponsorships and the travel, and the, you know, it's amazingly expensive. And so for a product manager, if he can save, you know, 50 cents on an item, like a pair of grips, you can imagine the difference on something like a fork, where it's a major expense
right.
of the overall cost of the bike.
Sure.
So, you know, our business is mostly aftermarket. I mentioned we work through KHS, and they have, I believe it's 25 or 26 sales reps that go around the country and visit dealers. And the bulk of our business is basically done through social media, word of mouth, people seeing a product and trying it. So
let me ask you just a quick question about your manufacturing and design.
Sure.
So who
sure.
came up with this inverted fork design? Whose idea was that?
Well, there was a friend of mine who is an OEM maker. And so he makes a lot of different products. One day he'll put your brand on it. The next day he puts my brand. And the next
Got
day
it.
Somebody else's. And so we saw an opportunity because there was a weakness in the market with the existing fat bike fork. So when we saw the opportunity, we went to the manufacturer and said, look, there are a dozen different improvements that you could make to the fork. The fork was okay, but it had issues. And so we slowly gained their confidence through engineering changes. And in return for that, we required exclusive manufacturing for the North American market. And we got that, and our volume has allowed us to expand that throughout Europe. And, you know, the relationships that you build with the Asian manufacturers are built upon a confidence that there is reliability, trust. And so everything we've done has been done on handshakes. There are no formal contracts. You know, we give a word that we're going to do something, and we do it. And so we're very grateful for the relationships that we have, and that's across. We have a couple of investors who've come to us that are factory owners in Taiwan, and some of those investors assumed we would just slap a Ren logo on their product, and that isn't the case. It needs to fit the direction that we want to take the company in delivering really world-class products. I'd put our products in any category up against anybody else. In the case of our lightweight stem, we are the lightest ISO-certified stem in the world. You, as a retailer, do not have a stem in your shop that's as light as our stem at any price, two times, three times the retail price. And we do that because we have the resources to provide truly a world-class product. And we do that because we want consumers to have good experience with our product so that when they're looking at suspension, they say, geez, you know, I'm familiar with these guys. Not everybody's running out and putting on a suspension fork. Almost anybody could use a proper fit, which, you know, it's more and more critical that you get yourself set up properly on the bike. And our stem is perfect for a retailer that looks to provide great value, quality product, and is backed up by, you know, service. You pick up the phone, you're talking to the owners. You're not talking to a clerk on the phone.
Right, right. All very cool points, very cool points.
Thanks.
And so they aren't nothing's actually manufactured here in the States.
No, we do all of our manufacturing in Taiwan. We source absolutely nothing out of China.
Any tariff issues? No, then you don't have any tariff issues. Awesome.
Nope, no tariffs out of Taiwan unless that changes.
Yeah, right, who knows, right?
Yeah, but for now, everything is good.
Good.
And we're really, really excited. We've got a tremendous amount of follow-up from the European show.
Good.
And,
good.
It is. It's exciting.
What do you think is going to happen here in the U.S. without Interbike? It would be happening right about now, as I remember, all those years that we attended. And it is outrageously expensive for a small manufacturer or somebody who has a product that is just a small product. I mean, we manufacture a helmet mirror, for example, and there is no way that we could ever go to a show like Interbike. Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can't change the light bulb. You have.
That's
you know,
right.
The,
oh, I forgot.
Union,
it's a union show.
Yeah,
unions,
the unions come in and it's $75 to change a light bulb. So, you know, it's something that you have to deal with. And then you stand in the booth and you talk to somebody for 20 minutes and you think you're getting your point across. And it turns out, you know, he's a friend of the owner who happened to get a badge to get into the show. I blame the show. I forget the word for it, but the people who put the thing on, they're
oh, the
greedy.
Expo managers. Yeah.
Yes. It's sad what's happened. And then, you know, the group now wants everybody to go to outdoor retailer, and that's not my customer, you know, the campers and those
right,
kind of things.
Right,
sure.
Right.
They may ride a bike, but the way the owners of the trade shows treat the suppliers, the charges, I mean, what they were charging retail for people to come into that show in Eurobike is amazing. And I believe the number was 20,000, 22,000 consumers that showed up on Saturday.
Did you write orders?
Well, yes, but, you know, we weren't looking to do onesie-twosies. So we opened a distributor in Germany, we opened a distributor in Poland, and another one in the Czech Republic. Again, we move at a nice pace. If you're my distributor, order what you can. You don't have to take my full line of products. You tell me what you can sell. You tell me how many pieces you could sell. And we're happy with that. We want to build a relationship. And the stronger that relationship is, the more you're going to explain your problems. The more I understand your problems, the more I have an opportunity to either offer a solution Or as Yoshi told me many, many years ago, don't waste my time. Don't waste your customers' time. Listen to their problem.
Such good advice. True. Yeah, of course
you
it
know,
is.
Yeah. Everybody's got a problem, and everybody's happy to explain to you their problem. So if you shut up and listen.
Maybe we'll give you an answer.
And the answer is, you know, let me check into it to see if I can help, or yes, I can help, or no, I can't. And
that's just being upfront with people and not leading them on. I know a lot of people have that issue with some bike shops. Let me check into it. And they never get back to them, for example. That's
right.
A really bad practice.
Yeah, credibility is important. And, you know, I've witnessed it many, many times standing in a bike shop and somebody walks in with, you name it, a Huffy or a Murray or an old Columbia. And the owner is telling them to get out. We don't service that stuff. And, you know, you never know what the opportunity is that man could be married to a world-class triathlon. And you don't see that opportunity because, well, it's the same thing with e-bikes. In the U.S., so many of my friends that own shops go, it's not a bike. I'm not going to do it. Well,
cut off your nose to spite your face.
Exactly. And those people are now, you're getting 55, 60-year-old people that are getting off the couch, going out, riding the bike. They need a more comfortable seat. They want to have the energy bar. They want to have a nice, you know, pair of, you name it, shorts, jersey.
Right.
And you want to turn that away because your arrogance is that's not a bike?
Well, I think part of that, Kevin, comes from who some of these shop owners are hiring. So if they were out on the floor actually making those decisions and talking with that customer, they might realize we had that same thing happen not too long ago that a guy called up and he had a flat on his e-bike. Come on. Any bike shop can fix a flat. I don't care who you are. And if you can't, you shouldn't be in business. And
that's right.
I don't even know how many shops turned him down. We don't sell e-bikes. We don't even sell off-the-rack bikes. Everything is custom. But Brian said, bring it in. I'll change
right.
your flat. I mean, come on. Really, who knows? He could turn around one day and be a much bigger customer or give you a referral that'd blow you away.
That's right. No, you never know. And, you know, when I sit on an airplane and you're flying for 13 hours and, you know, you pad it, if somebody next to me wants to talk, I'm happy to talk. If you want to be quiet and read a book and have your space, I'm fine with that. But you never know who's sitting next to
right.
you. And it doesn't hurt to be nice. It doesn't hurt to smile. And you just never know. Somebody could be an investment broker who says, you know what, we've been looking for a company like yours.
Exactly. And it those things have happened. I do know that.
Yeah, I agree.
This has been such a great conversation. You have really cool things to say. I'd like you to tell my listeners how to find out more about Ren Sports. And then I have three questions I always ask my guests.
Okay. Well, you can reach me 707-652-2737. And I'm happy to answer any questions about our products.
He answers the phone, too. I can tell you that.
I do. And you can also reach us on our website, which is Ren, W-R-E-N, sports with an S, .com.
Cool.
So go ahead with your questions.
Okay, ready? What's your favorite food?
My favorite food is meat and potatoes. That's my nickname in Japan, Nikito Imo. Yeah, meat and potatoes.
That's cute. That's very cute.
Well, it's
all
true.
Right.
I'm expensive. Kobe beef.
Well, that's true. That is expensive. You are so right.
Not every factory worker got fed Kobe beef.
That probably is true. So what kind of music do you like?
Blues. I'm a blues kind of guy.
Cool. And do you have any pets?
Do I have any pets? I got the best dog in the world.
That could be debatable, but tell me about your dog.
Well, he's a mutt. He's half Jack Russell Terrier, half Lab.
Interesting combination.
Yeah, we were lucky to find him. And he's a shop dog. He sits with me in the office and is my alarm bell when UPS shows up. So
right.
I love him. Yeah, absolutely.
What's his name?
Buddy.
Okay, then. Well, to you and Buddy, Kevin, thank you so much for talking with me. Continue to have a wonderful season, and we'll be putting all your stuff on our Facebook page, and we'll keep following Ren Sports. Kevin Ren, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Kevin Ren joined me from the offices of Ren Cycles in California. If you're interested in knowing more about the company and its products, you can log on to ren.com. WRENcycles.com. That's our show for this week. Thanks to all my guests, and thanks to you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show, and if you did, please vote with your positive comments on your favorite podcast app. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode of The Outspoken Cyclist. So I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening. Ride safely, and we'll see you next week.